Good evening, folks. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, delighted to know that you're on board for another great story by a fine local writer, Readly author Hope Knisley. We've had Hope on our show numerous times, and I know that you're not going to be disappointed because she always gives us a great narrative. Tonight, it's all about Austin on his way back to the very jail from which he and his buddy had escaped. The title of the story? Milk Run. And here's the author, Hope Knisley, to read it for us. Milk Run.
The Milk Run. Austin turned his face upward to soak in the direct heat of the sun, something he had missed in the last several days awaiting the next leg of this interminable milk run. His eyes caught the slow glide of a hawk floating overhead, and he swiveled as much as the chains would allow so that he could follow the hawk's flight, admiring its grace. He pictured himself soaring above all of this, over the van and away from the driver who was blathering on about nothing. As the hawk disappeared, he faced the sun, and when his pupils contracted with the glare, he closed his eyes and took a deep breath. He relished that moment when his eyesight went white from the sunlight, leaving sunspots in its wake, which he always thought of as dozens of tiny little supermen floating across his vision. It was like a mini high for him. At the moment, however, it was his ears that he wished would lose all sensation and not his eyes. The red-tailed hawk was worth watching, worthy of admiration. The idiot driver and his chatter was worthy of nothing. Austin was standing at the entrance to the Sallyport, between two 20-foot-high fences topped with razor wire. The guard was checking the van's undercarriage with his portable mirror. They were in a small town in a sparsely populated county, but he had lost track of where they were. It was just one more stop in his road trip across three states, the meandering travel that went from county to county, as slowly and steadily as the tortoise in that story he read in fourth grade. Sometimes, the small counties did not have a Sallyport, and the transfer would be directly out a door into the hold of a van or a car. Today they were confined between fences, and he got to be outside for a few brief minutes. Austin was happy to absorb the sun's heat, if only for a moment or two. Razor wire was stretched taut across the top of the fence. For today, he had no intention of trying anything. 7 months of running had been exhilarating, but today he was content to stand still and watch. He got that way on occasion, those rare times when his nervous energy slowed to a crawl and he became still, almost placid, for a few brief moments. The driver was spouting off about his night on the town. That was what the idiot called it, my night on the town, like the small-town nobody that he was. Although he had only been listening to him a few minutes, this guy had already become the idiot in Austin's mind. Austin wished he could move around to the side so that he could watch the guy's face while he spewed out the stuff about such inane and inconsequential things as getting drunk and sleeping with some nameless bimbo. He even used terms like boinking, for Christ's sake. She was a pretty little thing, but dumb as a bedpost. Wasn't even the best lay I ever had, but it had to do for one night. She was a redhead. I usually like redheads better, but she didn't like that I keep my gun by the bed. Tried to tell me it weren't necessary. Told me that I should put it in the other room, but I told her that she either slept with me and my gun or she didn't sleep with me at all. You just have to get that way with dumb broads so they don't run all over you. Which they'll do, you know, run all over you, if you let 'em. And I'll be damned if any girl will tell me where I can or can't keep my gun. Hell, man, I'd sleep with it if it would do me. He drew out girl in the slow, oblivious way of someone who thought about women a lot, but only as an extension of his own desires. The idiot prattled on, and Austin was, unfortunately, a captive audience, although he knew it couldn't last long. He couldn't move more than a few inches in any direction, and would be in trouble if he tried. So far, most of the counties had not shackled his feet for transport, but here in this rinky-dink corner of nowhere, the sheriff had clamped the chains on Austin's ankles and wrists with a definite smirk on his face. The mindless chatter mildly amused Austin with its irritatingly endless prattle. With nothing at all to say, the guy kept talking. Austin had the urge to snort loudly, ensuring that the guy would hear him, but for once, he held it in. "The little hotshot?" That would be his mother's voice in his head. He could hear her saying it with her usual tone of derision. "Little hotshot white boy who thinks he's the center of everyone's universe." She would say something like that about almost any male who let that note of braggadocio creep into his voice. Rich or poor, redneck or blue blood, CEO or welfare recipient, white, black, or brown, she was never tolerant of male bombast. And then on top of it, she usually held him, Austin, responsible for the sins of all men, or at least that was how it had always felt to him. She regularly pointed out male flaws of macho splendor, and then she'd turn to him and add, "And, Austin, you make sure that you never do anything like that." That could be anything she didn't like. Jokes or comments about women and the difficulty of relationships, attempts to sound tough, bragging about conquests, comments about what is women's work, and all those other locker room bluffs that guys spout with the regularity of ex-lax. She saved her finest vitriol for men who use terms like chick, girl. Unless she's under the age of 13, she's a woman, thank you very much. Broad, bitch, or God forbid something worse. Funniest of all was how much she hated gal. That one could get her to blow smoke out her ears. She would kill for an utterance of gal, and he had watched her nearly eviscerate Uncle Mike for it that Christmas that seemed so long ago. Austin knew he'd have to call on some supernatural protection from his mother if he ever dared lay a hand on a woman. Not that he had considered it, but he couldn't even begin to imagine the hell that would ensue if he did. She had stood by him through this incarceration, but he could rest assured that she would not be at his side if his crime included violence towards a woman. There came a day when Austin had finally let her know that he didn't particularly appreciate her never-ending attempts to make him bear the weight of everything that she considered to be vile and repulsive about men. "I've had it," he had told her, "with you making me feel like I'm innately evil, or at the very least, dirty. Why do you do that to me?" He could remember that conversation as if it were yesterday rather than when he was 17. They had been sitting at IHOP, eating short stacks and eggs over easy at the time. They all liked breakfast for dinner. His family had spent the day up in the mountains on a hike around Azure Lake. As they relaxed over dinner, their tiredness had morphed into giddiness and they had begun to try to solve the world's problems. What should the president do about the recession, and how the government should take care of aging baby boomers? Someone had even suggested a forced diet of McDonald's and Krispy Kreme donuts as a way to ensure that no one lived long enough to draw on their Social Security benefits. As the conversation moved on to more serious things, his sister had put in a dig about his friend Micah, insisting that Micah's girlfriend should leave his sorry ass for all the things he did to her. His mother, ready for her soapbox even when she was tired, had made a comment about men who mistreat women, then turned it into a warning for him. This time, Austin had snapped back, telling her that he had had enough, and from that day forward, he was refusing to carry the weight of all the world's testosterone-laden guys out there. His mother had just laughed and said that she wasn't making him carry anything, that she just wanted him to rid himself of the cloak of chauvinism and become a better man than most. He had replied that the sin of being male, if there was such a thing, certainly wasn't his problem. Besides, he had concluded, "I don't even wear coats, much less cloaks." She had laughed at this, and they all went back to their pancakes. Austin looked over at Jed, who was standing, also shackled, at the opposite corner of the back end of the van. If he could see himself, he knew he probably looked much like Jed, hairy and pathetically filthy from the past few months living in the mountains. The mouthy kid driving the van wasn't as dumb as he sounded. He maintained a distance between Jed and Austin. If the two of them got close enough to conduct even a semi-private conversation, they could, and would, find a way to escape. Austin knew they'd have no problem getting the best of the squirrely little idiot who was broadcasting the details of his night on the town. Thinking of his mom reminded him of how long it had been since he had talked to her. He knew that it hurt her and was a little bit sorry for that. He would have liked to tell her where he was for the past 7 months and reassure her that he was okay, but he hadn't been able to take the chance of letting her know in case the warden tried to contact her to see if she knew where he was. Besides, talking to her would make him get that sinking feeling again, and he didn't want to deal with that right now. Now that he and Jed were caught again and on their way back across several states to prison, he figured he'd be able to call her and Dad sometime soon to fill them in. Not that she'd like it. There would be a few choice names she'd call him before they got far into that conversation. Either that or she'd just go silent and hand the phone to his dad. Her silence was more deafening and condemning than her words. Jed's two brothers, Wade and Garth, who were certifiable card-carrying lunatics, had told him that they had seen his parents. Although they had never met his parents before, they were pretty certain that it was his mom and dad. From their description, he knew it was them. They said the woman had really short blonde hair and wore glasses. "And she was one angry bitch," Wade added. "She had steam coming out of her ears." After Jed and Austin had walked away from the halfway house, escaped would have been a bit of a misnomer, they really had just walked away, Wade and Garth had gone back to try to get Austin and Jed's belongings. Those two weren't the smartest guys on the planet, and they thought that if the halfway house would release his and Jed's meager possessions, they'd be able to retain anything of value before returning the rest to him and Jed. Instead, the two of them had almost got themselves arrested. The managers at the halfway house figured that if they wanted to get Austin's and Jed's clothes, they must know where the two escapees had gone after they had walked away from the place. The imbeciles. It took some quick talking to convince the police that they didn't know where Austin and Jed were, but they were detained a few days before the authorities released them. It was while Wade and Garth were at the facility to get Austin and Jed's stuff that a middle-aged couple had walked into the halfway house. When the guys heard the woman was asking about Austin, they paid attention. "She was so damned persistent," they said, "sort of like a nasty pit bull," and let them know that she was pissed off that she had to talk to a wall of one-way glass in order to communicate with an attendant. "What do you mean by telling me he's not here?" she had demanded. "He's got to be here. Do you just lose the residence on a regular basis? Is this a common occurrence?" Garth and Wade said that she was turning all shades of purple. Then when she turned to walk away, they said that she almost slumped on the floor. She had bent over at the waist and looked like she was going to fall over. The man with her, that would be his dad, had not said much up to that point, and now, while she was having a hard time standing up, had taken over the questioning through the glass wall. Then those two jackasses told Austin how they had sat there laughing at her like the lunatics that he knew them to be. What else could he have expected from them? Austin had to admit that he kind of liked knowing that his parents had been there, at that godforsaken hellhole. But today, 6 months later, they still didn't know where he was. From time to time, usually when he and Jed had been camping in the mountains, he had looked at the stars in the night sky and thought about the nights they had gone camping. On that island in the Adirondacks, in the South Dakota Badlands, in their own backyard, and wondered if they thought about him much or if they just went on with their lives like nothing happened. He'd given them plenty of reason to cut him off. He was reasonably certain they probably thought of it a time or two. Austin sensed, rather than heard, that the talking at the front of the van had stopped even before the idiot came into his range of vision. "Time to go," the guy bleated at them. "Get your sorry asses into the van." Austin stared at him. The guy really wasn't worth the evil eye that Austin was capable of giving. The most that this monkey deserved was a blank stare. The guy turned to open the back door so that they could hop in. He nearly pushed them over the bumper and into the gaping dark hole, their shackles clanking around them. It was what Austin called a dog kennel on wheels. There were no windows inside and only two molded plastic benches, one along each side of the back of the van. There was only a grated window covered with plexiglass that opened into the front section where the driver sat. It crossed his mind that perhaps he could sue them for not having seat belts. But it wouldn't do much good. He couldn't remember what county and which state they were in anymore. Besides, all of them operated with this lax attitude toward the safety of prisoners. Austin squinted into the darkness before the guy gave him an impatient push. "Go on, hop in," he squeaked. "What are you waiting for? Christmas? 'Cause I sure as hell hope you aren't here at Christmas. I want to get rid of you numbskulls before Halloween." He just kept going with more nonsense. "Unless you think you'd make a good spook for Halloween, I could put you in my front yard to scare the little kitties. If your looks wouldn't get them, the smell sure would." He cackled loudly, thoroughly entertained by his own joke. Yeah, well, after he and Jed had been caught again, no one had let them at the showers. They had been out in the woods for months, with only an occasional chance at a campground shower. It had been great, really, maybe even the best period of his life. They had been working in the mountains near Canyon City, picking up pine cones and selling them. Sounded kind of lousy, but it wasn't really. They could pick up 5 to 10 gunny sacks full a day and sell them for a boatload of money. The little new-agey shop owners paid big bucks for them and then turned them into crap to sell to the cloned new-agey tourists who flocked to the mountains from the cities to experience the great outdoors. A guy could sell anything that was back to earth to these people. Austin could imagine them taking the doodads back to their city apartments to grace their windowsills and little knick-knack shelves. Little knick-knack shelves for little people. It was the same kind of people who read literary magazines and who are really touched by the stories written by hardened convicts. They might not resonate with the experience, but it was almost like they wished they could. What kind of pleasure they got out of the stories and lives of convicts, he would never know. He chuckled, thinking how uncomfortable he made these same people when they had to stand beside him in, oh, let's say, the grocery store checkout line. If they knew he was an escaped convict, they might try to react with nonchalant ease to show just how magnanimous and progressive they were. But they would squirm, even if it was only an internal squirm. He could always feel the inevitable withdrawal, the barely perceptible uneasiness, the recoiling of a body that clearly wanted to dash the other direction, but was being restrained. Austin was sensitive to that feeling in people, but he really wouldn't complain about them too much. Their odd interests, their attraction to all-natural knick-knacks, and their excess dollars kept him afloat out there in the mountains. It only took a few bags of pine cones to supply him with several weeks' worth of groceries. It didn't take much to live out there. That had been the great part. He and Jed had slept outside until they made enough money to buy a tent and 2 sleeping bags at the Army surplus store. Then they pitched their tent on Forest Service land, and all they needed was a little gas money and some food. Their biggest expense was getting pot from the locals. They had just begun to grow their own when that blasted taillight had gone out and the cops stopped them. Routine traffic stop. That's all it took. Isn't that what the news always said? It was on a routine traffic stop when? Then the announcer would finish the story with whatever it was. The cop got shot, or the parolee was caught, or they found the little girl. In their case, it was the escapees who got caught several states away from the place of their original crimes and place of incarceration. And now they were on their way back, moving from county to county in this tediously boring milk run. The monotony was seldom broken. The food was sparse and nearly inedible. They still hadn't got the opportunity for a shower. The guards were vindictive, and the days were unending. Really, not so much unlike prison itself, except that they were herded into a van or some kind of prison transport every couple of days. The most interesting thing on the entire run was when they stopped at an institution for the criminally insane to pick up that guy for transport to the state prison. The guards had warned them, "Whatever you think of doing, do not get out and do not go near the entrance. If you manage to wander inside here or even onto the grounds, we might never be able to get you out." The dude they had picked up was silent most of the way. Near their destination, he finally spoke. "Keep in mind to press recording." Austin had stared straight ahead. If he had looked at Jed, they would have laughed, and they knew better than to do anything that might set this psycho dude off. That was the only thing on the trip that made it worth it. By this time, the van was on the road, and Austin's reverie was interrupted by a violent turn to the right. The little idiot drove like he talked, fast and careless. He was the kind who was probably sitting up front laughing, knowing what was happening to his passengers in the back. On these milk runs, Austin was realizing that you see all kinds, same as in prison. Each county jail and every county employee was different. On a few legs of the trip, he had been alone in a backseat of a car with someone. One guy had even bought Austin a cup of coffee when he got some for himself. When the run was in a car, he could catch glimpses of smaller towns out the windows. Some of the cops had been talkative. Others maintained a strict distance between themselves and their prisoners. A few, like this one, were arrogant and acted like a real dick. It was difficult to remain upright on the bench with feet shackled together while being driven around 35-mile-per-hour curves at 50 or more. At the first curve, and there were many as they headed east out of the mountains, all four of the guys in the back found themselves on the floor. They had just got back on the benches when they hit the next curve. Clearly, something had to be done about this. "Hey, what do you say we teach this idiot a lesson?" Austin asked the guys sitting around the back of the van. Jed was in sync with his idea, even before he said what he was thinking. The hefty dude on the other side of the van, the one with the snake up his arm, nodded too. "What do you got?" Snake Arm asked. The short dude in the opposite corner didn't say anything. He just looked ready to heave his meager breakfast across the back of the dog kennel. "Okay, so how about this? All of you come over here," Austin told them. "Let's see what happens if we sit on the same side around the next curve in this direction. When we feel the start of a curve, throw your weight this way. If we tip the van on its side, we might be able to sue the bastards." Just as Jed started to say, "Let's think this through," the driver jammed on the brakes and they were flung against the front of the van. Picking themselves back off the floor, Snake Arm spoke. "What's to think about?" he asked. "Let's do it." "Yeah, but if he turns right, we want to be on the right side. If we're on the left side, it's not the same." "Well, it depends on what we want to do," the quiet guy in the corner spoke for the first time. "I'll tell you what we want to do. We want to tip the van," Austin told him. "We can do that if we're on the same side that he's turning towards." The van took another curve to the right. They were a bit more prepared this time, and they all stayed in place. "So everybody over here," Austin ordered. "It won't matter. Even if the next curves are in the other direction, the road will curve this way again." Austin and Jed scooted close to make room for the others. They squeezed together on the bench as close to the side wall as they could get. The driver was picking up speed again and must be close to 55. It wouldn't seem so fast if they weren't coming down the mountain. He felt the elation rising in him. The second they felt the beginning of the curve, they braced themselves to hold their places. By the time the van had moved into the curve, they could feel it. Austin let go of a laugh, and at his side he could hear the rise of pleasure and the sounds emanating from his collaborators. The left side of the van was rising perceptibly into the air. As the left side left the ground, they heaved their bodies toward the right. Above the whine of the engine, the rush of the wind, and their own laughter, they could hear the best sound of all. Through the plexiglass came the faint, harsh scream of the driver. It was music, clear and sweet to their ears. For a few seconds, Austin thought they were really going to flip over on the side, but as the driver slowed the van and came out of the curve, it thudded down on all four tires. The curses continued to float through the thin space between the front and the hold of the van. There would be, Austin knew, unpleasant repercussions at the next stop. For a moment it felt as if he would never stop laughing, the first good belly laugh he'd had since they began this milk run. Snake Arms moved back to the other side without much expression at all. The little guy still looked ready to hurl chunks, but now he had the faintest hint of a sickly grin on his lips. He was positive there would be retribution, but what did it matter? As the driver began to pick up speed once again, Austin leaned back against the hard plastic bench seat. There was no getting comfortable while shackled in the back of this van, but for a moment he could relax and imagine the landscape outside, the pine trees, the narrow road, perhaps even a small lake or a stream. He sighed and thought of what awaited him at the end of the road. No bags of pine cones, no campfire under the stars, and definitely no New Age tourists. Just guards who withheld personal mail on a whim, a few crazy ministers trying to convert them, a cellmate who, if he was lucky, just left him alone, and occasional letters from his mother.
Hope Knisley reading Milk Run. As we heard, it's all about Austin, who along with his buddy Jed walked away from their halfway house and spent 7 months up in the mountains living on the money they made collecting pine cones they sold to vacationers. Although the story never comes out and says so, we certainly have to consider that Austin's mother, a die-hard feminist who blames the status of women on hateful and intolerant men, her son no exception, seems to have a lot to do with Austin's problems. Well, the two escapees get rearrested and found themselves shackled in a windowless van being transported back to prison. One time, as the van turned rather quickly, going over some mountain curves, all four of the prisoners inside tried to lean toward the outside curve to make the van tip over, and along with the screams of the driver, it almost did. He, the driver, will probably pay them back, so Hope tells us. And so it's back to prison for Austin, where he can look forward to guards who withhold personal mail on a whim, crazy ministers who try to convert the prisoners, cellmates who hopefully will just leave him alone, and occasional letters from his mother. All that said, we have to wonder what life has in store for Austin from here on out. Thank you, Hope Knisley, for such an engaging story. As we told you at the outset, we've had Hope on our show a number of times, always enjoy her stories, and are happy to report that a recent story she read on our program entitled The Black Box was published in the Pacific Journal. We certainly hope that she'll send us more of her fiction in seasons to come. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Jim Ashford. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.